Welcome to The Logstat, the Army's premier podcast on all things sustainment, where we analyze new developments, discuss current trends, and forge the path ahead for the next generation of sustainment soldiers. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of The Logstat. I'm your host, Captain Garrett Pyle. Today, we're continuing our mini-series on the trends of the brigade and below by moving across the Atlantic Ocean and focusing on the Army's only Forward Station Combat Training Center, or CTC. The Joint Multinational Readiness Center, JMRC, is a Europe-based CTC that is situated near Hohenfels, Germany. It hosts a variety of annual training exercises with our European allies and partners. Its mission is to train brigade combat teams and divisions in a theater-informed multi-domain battlefield by providing joint and combined arms exercises in the European AOR to increase the scale, capability, readiness, and interoperability of the United States, allies, and partners. To guide us through the various trends and how sustainment units are operating at JMRC, I have with me today Lieutenant Colonel Andrew Horn, who serves as a senior sustainment trainer at JMRC. Lieutenant Colonel Horn is a native of Oregon and commissioned from the Pacific Lutheran University as a quartermaster officer in 2006. He has served at Germany, JBLM, and Schofield Barracks with deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. His years of experience in both the tactical and as an OCT are going to make for a fascinating conversation today. He has a Bachelor of Arts degree in Business Administration and a Master of Science in Supply Chain Management from the University of Kansas. I'm just really excited to have you on the show today, sir. Welcome.
Hey, Garrett. Excited to be here. I want to first give a thanks to you and the backside support for being so flexible. Looking forward to the conversation, and hopefully I can add a little something to what is your great product here, the Logstat podcast.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, we're excited to have you on and just this dialogue we're going to have. Like, you know, we've already talked with NTC, JRTC, so it's nice to be able to see a different perspective and how the Army provides training opportunities for the force. And as I mentioned before, JMRC is the Army's only forward station CTC. So I know that's going to have a lot of unique opportunities, even its own unique challenges. So can you tell us more about how that separates you from the others and what makes you truly so unique?
Yeah, you know, I'll talk about from our perspective, right? Because I think I haven't sat in this seat at the other rotations, but I have been through them, obviously. You know, JMRC, we have our multinational partners and allies. They do participate in the rotations. And I think currently right now, I think is what I could probably most clearly talk about. They provide critical capabilities to the primary training audience. Think like EW or MPs, that sort of thing. Additionally, they also have like brigade headquarters that would or could provide the CPX brigades that help train the division HICOM as sort of a secondary training audience, if you will. I think historically that ebbs and flows in terms of the involvement, but obviously given our geographic location, certainly plays to, you know, the multinational allies and partners, if you will. So I don't know if that answers the question or not.
Yeah, because the other ones, I know they're focused on NTC. You think of it as, oh, this is where the armor is going to be going. Big open deserts, you know, get lost out there. JRTC has more of that, hey, you know, that light aspect, focusing more on that swamp area, but, you know, a lot more lighter. Whereas, you know, you just talked about you'll be working with the unique capability of working with international partners. And kind of the way I just described it, how would you describe the environment of JMRC compared to the other CTCs?
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to step on you there. But yeah, you know, you your last comment there brought up a good point. So maybe one of the other things that you know, not separates, but it gives us a little more distinction or uniqueness, I guess, is we see all flavors and all types of units come through here, right? So not only Striker, Airborne, Air Assault, and obviously heavy rotations as well too. And we're seeing an increase of heavy rotations as well. In terms of environment, it kind of You know, Homefellas, if you've come through, you absolutely know this. It gives you its best punch, no matter what time of year you come through. If you're coming through in a winter rotation, you are undoubtedly going to see anything from snow and ice to fog to, you know, low freezing temperatures preventing you from the ability to fly to, you know, you know, increased difficulty and trafficability across the G-locks. For us here at JMRC2, it's not just the box. We have this thing called the Maneuver Rights Area, or the MRA. Technically, it extends, roughly speaking, anywhere from the Homefellas training area box proper all the way north to Graffenbeer area. And so anything in between there is sort of in play, if you will, with some handrails on that. Obviously we're not going to go straight through a civilian entity, you know, town set or anything like that, and just take over. However, we can sort of, within the rules, like play amongst the population, if you will. So it's a little uniquely flavored, and every rotation is different as well too. So it's not just an east to west fight every time. I've seen our rotations here have been different every time, whether that be participants or where we're starting, or like I said, east to west, west to east, or the types of things we're doing in the phases, if you will. So that's sort of to put a little more on your initial question. That's sort of what makes JMRC, I guess, JMRC.
It's kind of neat, like, you know, to have that. Plays, you said, play area between those two areas. That does add a different uniqueness to your operating area. I know when you talk about the weather, I got the opportunity to be a guest OC when I was over in Atlantic Resolve, worked with a Lithuanian unit. And I just remember it was raining for a little bit and then it changed to snow. I just remember some of the track vehicles just completely got stuck into the heavy mud there. Yes, and then,
right.
And then came the snow on top of that.
Yep. Yeah. So, you know, really well, right? Like there's no other experience like that, I guess, with the changing environment. It's going to give you its best shot. That's for sure. And you know that for sustainers, it's pretty cool because we can really, you know, get after extending locks and that sort of thing. We have a German location. It's called the Omberg training area, which is roughly 25 clicks or so away, which allows for, you know, BSB LSB headquarters to be to really extend those locks at least with one or two of their nodes, what have you. Sort of just you know, depends on what they want to do, but increases the challenge in terms of sustaining the brigade by allowing us to really extend our locks beyond what just the box proper allows for.
So what's it like to be an RTU, like that rotational training unit, versus being an OCT, specifically there at JMRC?
Okay, yeah. So I think if someone's listening to this and they've gone through a rotation, they know very well kind of what that CTC experience is like. And I don't think it varies that much to a degree anyways. You know, the suck is the suck, if you will. Doesn't matter what CTC you're going through. But we really look at them as they are the man or the woman in the arena. You know, that whole Teddy Roosevelt quote. From the OC side, I mean, we are trying our best to really observe, coach, and train those folks. And sometimes that C, we talk about the C becomes control when it comes to safety and that sort of aspect to it. Undoubtedly through a whatever it is, a 9, 10, 12 day rotation, we're sort of the last stand between somebody doing something, getting after mission, and making sure everybody gets back safe, right? So there's that aspect to it, but we're charged with providing that five pillar experience is also what we say. So it's the op four and the operating environment, us as OCs, instrumentation, the facilities here at JMRC, and then obviously the RTU. And that's uniquely different than probably any other sort of collective training that brigade does prior to coming to a CTC. And so the OCs are also experienced in that position, right? So they are veterans of whatever it is they're observing, and we're actively providing unbiased sort of reviews and coaching, like I mentioned before, and sort of like best practices and TTPs as well. I don't know if that's really the if that, hopefully that answers it, I guess, in terms of it's not, you know, RTU versus OC. We truly are trying to meet the unit where they're at and taking them just beyond where they think they can get to in terms of making the training as difficult as they can handle while still getting, you know, some value, some learning value and training value out of that event, if that makes sense.
Oh, it does. It does. And, because I know we're going to talk more later in our conversation specifically about, you know, some preparing for units that are going there, as well as if you're an OC going there preparing. So I know we'll get more into that in the conversation. One of the things I've talked about some of our previous conversations with the CTC miniseries, how really units need to have that focus of not just focused on winning, but focus on getting that training value out of while they're, you know, seeing what some of their areas they need to focus on, get some better training on, not just sitting there for, I got to win this game. I know that's something, I don't know if have you've had that similar experience or not.
Yeah, I think, you know, we have some pretty candid conversations, and we remind the unit, it's not you versus the sim or you versus the OCs or that, because there's really not a lot of training value or learning that can occur in that space. And so we have a lot of conversations about exactly kind of what you're talking about, right? So it's your systems, it's your processes, and it's really like, hey, were you effective, I guess, in the things that you were doing? And hopefully if OCs we're doing our job right, not only do we create the environment for that learning to occur, but we also allow the unit to see themselves, I guess, through our instrumented AARs, and they have that candid discussion internally to the unit, and walk away from the rotation with those either lessons learned or do outs to themselves, essentially, on how to best improve the unit going forward.
So that kind of gets right into our next topic, which is really the main focus of this mini series, is like the trends. Like, what trends are you really seeing when it comes at the brigade and the below, especially from the sustainment side?
Yeah, I think having talked to my counterparts, I think a lot of our trends are, if not the same, very similar. And some of them, I guess the most interesting thing to talk about from my lens anyways, is the synchronization in the C2, I guess, within sustainment, as units are going to the distributed like cluster model for the BSAs, things become a lot more difficult. And so anything that the unit did in its traditional BSA form is now, you know, 2-3 times harder, if not more, doing that distributed. So when you think about a sustainment rehearsal and doing that through distributed means, even when you just think about, you know, how am I displaying my log cop, both digital and analog, and now I have to do that across multiple nodes, not only just internal to my organic BSB unit, but across the brigade as well. Things become, you know, exponentially more difficult the more we sort of disperse. We gain survivability, obviously, but the leadership aspect to it in the C2 aspect to that becomes, I think, anyways, exponentially more difficult. And some of that's hindered by or helped by, you know, whatever variation of technology they're bringing into the fight, right? So and probably all levels of that come with pros and cons, right? So the most tick advanced units, you know, some of that stuff becomes easy, but then they're also inundated with other things, you know, in terms of, I don't want to say misuse, but, you know, with the unfamiliarity of using that type of new tech. So that's probably where I'd start with is like I said, distributed means making things, increasing our survivability, but making things, at least in the sustainment synchronization and C2, perhaps a little more difficult. I think also to units that have probably the most success, think about that distributed laydown, if you will, like how they're going to fight. If I'm coming in with, you know, a 2-up-1-back node model, or cluster model, if you will, like what are the roles and responsibilities of that now potentially a new node OIC, if it's not a commander or if it is a commander, are we asking our, because oftentimes they become like multifunctional nodes, which I think is in line with the CASCOM white paper and how we fight the BSA to a degree. But we sometimes don't task organize until we drop into that node on, you know, D4 or X1, if you will. And so having those roles and responsibilities clearly defined prior to LD, I think goes a long way for the man or woman on the ground in charge of that node, or you know, the company commander, if you will, if it's not them.
So you brought up a couple points that I kind of want to look at. The first is, you know, talking about the C2 side of the house. Have you been seeing a lot of units, you know, working with the next gen C2? I know that was like our winter edition focus of the Army Stand Professional Bulletin. So we were able to, you know, highlight a lot of that new capability. I didn't know how much experience you have seen out there so far with that.
Yeah, so the most advanced, really like what we're seeing is probably what I'd call like a tick light, if you will. And that's, I think, I mean, things are changing so rapidly that really what we're just seeing is the Starlink and the Starshields sort of advanced the ability for folks to establish comms pretty easily. And with that comes like the Maven and the Wicker and all that stuff, you know, the mode at which you're or operating through those communication channels. So that's really probably what we've seen the most of in terms of, you know, sort of tick flavor, communication advancement, if you will.
Okay. And then you brought up a good point about how units are now operating more dispersed. And we see that, whereas we can't just set up one giant BSA anymore and have this, the hard stands and everything, like, you know, what we've seen in recent times, to the last 20 years. So when you're going through that and how units have to be dispersed, I know you brought up the great point of like, hey, it adds a challenge to be able to, especially when it comes to C2, when you have things everywhere, these little base clusters. What are some good ways you've seen be successful when it comes to, when on the sustainment side, setting up base clusters?
Yeah, so this is a super challenging topic, right? Because I think that white paper does a really good job at you know, everything that went into sort of its recommendation there with the wargaming and everything. I think what we probably see the most of is units come out and disperse, right? Go into the node, the cluster format, if you will, essentially break into three nodes is what we kind of call them. And then extend the G-locks. And I think that is good. Like that does increase survivability to a degree. The caveat is that what we kind of argue is like, there is no safe haven. Just because you're 20 clicks away, it doesn't make you untouchable. Right. And we're kind of seeing that play out in real time here, in a neighboring theater, right? Like there is no place that's a safe haven in this theater if we were to go to war. And so we have that conversation, right? It's not the only way to increase your survivability, and you certainly can't disperse at the expense of enabling the brigade. Like you have to do the thing still. And so like, how else can you increase your survivability other than just increasing your locks? And I think that's sort of the conversation space that we get into most often, because it's, I don't want to say it's easy because it's not, but it's sort of the first step in many steps to make yourself more survivable while also enabling the brigade to do the thing, if that makes sense.
It does. And could you explain better the G locks for the audience who's unfamiliar with that?
Yeah, I'm sorry. So ground lines of communication, really. So that's we're just talking the log pack operations, trucks on the ground, offsetting yourself from the front line of trace. You know, around 20 or 30 clicks is sort of a sweet spot, I think, for us. I shouldn't say for us, but for units, I think that's really sort of, you know, offsets them enough to get them out of immediate range, and maybe like even sort of away from like the SPF threat, or not, I shouldn't say away from it, but further away, allows them some time and space to react to any sort of enemy threat in the area while not being immediately, you know, the next phase line behind the brigade, if you will.
And you highlight a great point, sir, is that just because we're, as you said, 20 clicks back or whatever, how far back from the forward line of troops or the flot, doesn't mean you're not in range of any kind of strike, especially whereas being sustainers, you know, we are being more of a prime target, because if you can take out a unit's supply lines, it's harder for them to fight. So that's what we need to recognize, is it's not that hard stand, forward operating base. We're all going to have these giant BSAs. We need to have that dispersion so we can have that higher mobility, higher survivability. So it's just awesome to see how each CTC is seeing how that units are testing that out, because I know different units are trying this concept out differently, especially what works to their formation.
100%. Yeah, spot on.
And I know there's going to be there's a lot of aspects that go into a unit being successful, just not in a CTC rotation, but, you know, any operation you're faced with. That's something we're kind of looking at every CTC is what you're seeing when it comes to how units are, you know, how they're preparing? Like, can you walk us through some of the planning actions with the supported units, like how they're setting the conditions to be successful?
Yeah. So are you asking for like the training glide path prior to showing up to CTC, or just like the administrative planning side of things?
So we'll focus on like more the training glide path, like what units are doing to set them up before they even hit ground net. So I would say the training on the first end.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, so from this is maybe another thing that makes us somewhat unique. So for JMRC, we are most often getting one of the RAF units here that's rotating through. And that has most frequently been on the backside of a rotation. So they're over here for real world deployment, and it actually makes their lives a little more complicated when it comes to executing one of these rotations, because they've most likely been operating, you know, disaggregated for you know, the previous 7 or 8 months, if you will. So they actually don't get much, if any, collective training prior to. So incredibly difficult for a brigade to come together then at the end of a rotation and get after some collective training. You know, our other two permanently assigned units, we have 173rd and 2CR. They're actually not much different in terms of, because their day-to-day jobs, a lot of it doesn't, they struggle to, I think, achieve, and I don't think this is a disparaging comment, but because of what they're asked to do on a day-to-day basis, they are unable or don't have as much sets and reps when it comes to collective training in their glide path that they would prefer probably or want prior to coming to the CTC and the collective training event, if you will. So I didn't answer your question there at all in terms of like what we're seeing units in terms of like getting after in a successful way. I'm highlighting it's a known challenge, and I think units are doing their best given the constraints that they're operating in. You know, it goes back to, I think the takeaway would be we do have what we call here A days. That's like our combat power builds and that sort of thing. And D days prior to going, stepping off an LDN for, you know, X1, if you will. Extremely important for units coming through to take advantage of those days that you are now here collectively. And not just like it would be very easy to sort of just sit around and you know, our location is called Ahoff or Albertshof, where units typically come through and sit down on their way up. But you could really get after some actually collective training in those A days and D days to at least take away some of that friction. Right, it's not going to be the best, but could you pull your team in and do some rehearsals? Could you pull the team in and talk about node responsibilities and hey, this is how we're going to task org and start to align that way and start to report that way? You know, getting into those battle rhythm events as soon as you get on ground and not waiting until those last days, I think is probably the best advice I could give a unit coming through JMRC.
No, and that worked. You've got some good information there, sir. And anything also for the admin? I know you kind of went some of the glide path there. Anything on the admin side of the house?
No, for units that are coming here, and I'm not sure if this is, I don't think it's unlike the other CTCs, but there's obviously, you know, initial, mid, and final planning conferences that occur. We're at all of those. And then in addition to those official planning conferences, our team will reach out directly with the unit to liaise, if you will, on what their concept of support is, what they're thinking, and we'll sort of start our coaching process in that moment in terms of, hey, here's where I'm thinking about putting the PHA or the MACP, and we'll coach through all those sort of like, hey, here's the pros and cons of that, or hey, maybe strongly don't do that, you know, if you will, or if you do, here's sort of kind of what you're looking at. So we take that pretty seriously, because what we don't want to do is somebody set off in the wrong direction completely. That's not in line with their training objectives, if you will, or you know, will make them ineffective, I guess. So there's those coaching points. We also do, some LTP as well too. We have green suitor supported LTP at times, and that sort of varies based off of the rotation, but it's not uncommon for us to, we're the Adler team here. So we'll have Adlers forward facing the unit in LTP. And so oftentimes, just depending on the timing of when that occurs, that might be our first engagement with that RTU as well too. You know, I guess I'd count that towards the administrative preparation for the CTC as well.
Perfect. And that kind of And then walk us into this next part of our conversation is when it comes to command post operations and like what sustainment fighting products, what have you witnessed, good, bad, or indifferent with those?
Oh boy. Yeah. So I think it goes back to my earlier comment, right? Like things are, in one way becoming a little easier, if you're coming with the Starlinks and the Star Shields. So, you have, I think, if not good comms, you have, I'm safe to say like reliable comms to a degree. It's a little easier to achieve, some connective tissue through comms, at least through, Starlink Star Shield. But I guess I would encourage units to go back to ATP 6-0.5, that command post operations, right? And think about what they should have, doctrinally speaking, at least in their command post. And really, I'm talking to the battalion MCP, and they should be able to do all those things. When it becomes complicated, because they're going to go into this, most likely into this cluster model. And so now you have, either company CPs or cluster CPs, if you will, but most often it's a company CP sort of acting as both. But what does that company CP need to have? And having that candid conversation before you LD, I think is really important. Oftentimes, it's not always known, not to say that it's not, but I think there's expectations, from a battalion commander, and then sort of the expectations from the company level, that hey, this is my first time coming out here. This is what I thought I was supposed to do, right? So understanding what you want your companies to do, and as a company commander, just make sure you understand what your boss wants you to do and thinks is important, right? And work that into your TTPs, right? Like when you're establishing your sites, like that should probably be nested in with your all your TTPs when you're occupying that cluster. I think that dispersion also, and this is probably nothing new, but as we disperse, we may lose our staffs when what was a thin staff maybe becomes even less robust through our dispersion, and we've sort of seen that go a number of different ways. And I think it's kind of interesting space to be in right now and sort of just observe, is there more payoff, like sort of, dispersing my, like, let's say my SPO section, right? Like maybe I want a little bit of my SPO over here and a little bit of my SPO, at my MCP, or do I keep my entire SPO section as one, keep it organic, but maybe throw a slice element forward at the point of friction. Same could be said, across the staff internal as well too. Like how does that dispersion affect your ability to battle track? It can be a monumental task for, that battle captain to understand when every log pack is going out, especially if you're coming with a dynamic log pack support, or even if it's just a log pack that's taking off from a different node 20 clicks away. Pretty easy report to send up, but if there's 40 or 50 other reports coming in that's not like a disciplined way to and reporting method, then that stuff gets lost. And so, we gain this connective tissue and reliable comms, but it's almost, we also have to remember there's a disciplined approach to reporting, just understanding our systems and processes that I think allow us to achieve, effective, support through the brigade, without losing all that stuff, if that makes sense.
No, it does, sir. And you bring up the age old debate, it feels like, with the SPO concept of where should the SPO be? How should it be dispersed? I've talked about it a few different episodes now. That's always an interesting concept. I feel like I should just do a whole episode on that with some different people and just see how that conversation, that debate goes. Because as you're just alluding to, like, there's different ways to do it on where should the SPO be? Who should be with the SPO? Like, how does that operate with the 4? How does that operate with the 3? So I said that gives me an idea for a future episode.
And I won't go too far on it, but what I'll say is, just commit, right? And when you commit, that probably doesn't mean just like, go Leroy Jenkins commit. I mean, like, just define the roles and responsibilities of that commitment that decision that you're making. And that will go so much further than just, maybe just, you know, cycling over, like, should I or shouldn't I, you know, push them there, push them there. Like that is an interesting conversation as well too, but just defining the roles and responsibilities of whatever your decision is, I think goes a really long way to make that decision more effective in the long run.
It does. And that kind of gets after some of our previous talking points when it comes to the training that leads up to before you go to a CTC rotation, the products you have, and how critical it is, especially when it comes to your unit's SOPs. Don't just say, oh, I got one on the shelf, we're good to go. Like, have you actually pulled off the shelf, dusted the dust off, and actually refined it? Not just say, oh, I clicked the box because I have it, but how critical it is to actually do some sets and reps prior to hitting ground. So people know, now I've talked about this in the previous episodes, like, can you set up your talk? Who's responsible for what? Like, how critical is to your success at, you know, for instance, here at JMRC, like, have people, you know, set up, have they trained on setting up the talk or the company CP? Who's doing exactly what, right, and how?
Yeah.
I imagine you've probably seen some of that go good and bad during your experience.
Yeah, exactly right. And like I said, you know, everybody's gonna get punched in the face, I guess. It's just when you want to experience that, I think. And so the units that are that sort of commit, and when I'm saying that, like, not just to my previous comment, but even just, you know, flipping the switch, if you will, early on in those A days and making it hard on themselves, I think you're better postured going forward, to, you know, endure the X days, going forward.
So when it comes to, being a JMRC and having that, you know, all these different exercises we've operated with our partner allies throughout the years, what's it been like for units, US units, when they're working with our partner nations and allies at JMRC?
Yeah. So I think, really for our US units, it's an interoperability conversation, right? And sometimes, honestly, that's a US interoperability challenge, as we have our own struggles, as we come together collectively to ensure that we're interoperable. Like, we have recently had a conversation about even just, you know, units that are not organic to my unit now attaching to my task force. There's an interoperability challenge there because they're not familiar with our SOPs, if you will, right? So we often talk about, even like I said, just US to US, but that same conversation applies with, you know, allies and partners as well too. Some of that is, and we have like an interoperability matrix to sort of not assess really, but just observe and give feedback to how, you know, good or bad, I guess, we are, when it comes to interoperability. A lot of that is your age old, hey, just throw a human at it, you know, put that LNO forward, and make that LNO hurt, right? Like, that's sort of an old adage of, like, you want to send your best to be an LNO, and it should hurt you. So that way it's paying you dividends, because that person is most likely going to be, I don't want to say alone and unafraid, but at least not under your, you know, close watch and eye, right? So you want them to be able to operate on your behalf with little to no guidance at times, or at least not as much as you'd probably want. And you'd probably want to think about what is it you're going to give them to enable comms back, right? Like, because the worst thing to do would be to put an LNO out somewhere and then you sort of just lose that person, right? So, you know, think through what your LNO kit might look like, whether that's, you know, analog or digital systems that are either provided by you or the gaining unit. I kind of mentioned it before as well too. Like, hey, these are our SOPs. Please read this. That's like sharing tax ops, if you will, is also goes a long ways to interoperability. And then obviously, especially with multinational allies and partners, there's the technical piece as well too. Like, does our fueler play with your fueler? Does our LHS PLS play with your crops? That sort of conversation that, we always hash that out in the A days, and there's, you know, potentially some training involved with those things, or at least some familiarization with that equipment that folks might not be, you know, used to on a day-to-day basis.
So any good advice you would give to, for instance, like a young LNO who's never worked in any interoperability, or like a young company commander, this is his or her first time working with a partner nation or an ally?
Yeah, so I think, do not leave without a clear understanding of what your boss is sending you away to do, right? That'd be one. Like, it's not a vacation. In fact, you've just been given probably more role and responsibility than anybody else back at, the MCP and what have you. Because like I said, you're operating alone and unafraid and on behalf of the boss. And if the gaining unit is using you correctly, they'd be looking over to you and looking for holistic answers that you may or may not have. So leaving without that guidance is probably, you're going to set yourself up for failure. And then immediately establishing comms, and it better be with the right people. Like, you need to know not just how to establish comms, but who to talk to as well too, because you're not going to have enough time to just go through your Rolodex and start picking up the phone and calling one person after the other. If there's an RFI, you need to know exactly who owns that RFI, and you might not have enough time, or the person on the other end might not have time to answer every one of your RFIs, right? So, for example, if you're calling back to the battle captain and making comms with them, they might not have the time or the bandwidth to answer every one of your RFIs. Like, you need to know that belongs to the S2, or you need to know that that's actually in the other node, if you will, and you need to be calling forward to them. So I think being disciplined in your approach in terms of not just how you're calling back, but who you need to call to get the answer, and then maintaining that, whole understanding of what the unit's doing, where we're sort of at in the movie, what's the brigade doing, what's the BSB collectively trying to get after in this current fight. I think that sets an LNO up for success.
Thank you for that, sir. It's always good to have that wisdom, especially because I know there'll be some listeners out there like, I'm about to be an LNO for the first time. What do I even do?
Right.
So it's good to be able to have some of that wisdom to share with them so they can be set up for success. And on that, like, when it comes to combat skills for sustainment and support soldiers, how can we be more lethal?
Yeah. So, and I think you're talking for like support soldiers is kind of, is that what you're gearing this towards?
Yeah. Us as sustainers, logisticians and such, how can, when it comes to those combat skills, how can we be more lethal?
Yeah. I think so. This is an interesting time to be, I think, at any CTC, as we are leaning, and as an army writ large, I guess, leaning heavy into, transformation and really sort of chasing edges on the far side of that in terms of innovations and that sort of thing. On the opposite side of that spectrum, we have a lot of conversations about getting back to the basics. And, I've been in for a little bit of time now, and I've heard that back to the basics terms being used for a good portion of my career. The reality is, that's a truism, I guess, that applies to most units that come through. Like PCCs and PCIs are never going out of style. They just aren't. Convoy briefs are never going out of style. The establishment of security is never going out of style, and that just contributes to your ability to survive. And if you can't survive, obviously you can't do the job that we're called to do, which is to enable the brigade, right, through all our levers. We talk a lot about, you have to block and tackle before you run the flea flicker, and that's sort of like surviving is the blocking and tackling, and probably our logistics jobs are probably running the flea flicker to a degree, I guess. Because if we're not alive, we can't do that. Warrior skill, level one training, sergeant time training, that's all very relevant, in 2026. And I don't think it's ever going to go out of style. I talked a little bit about earlier about, the CASCOM, how to fight the BSA white paper, and a lot of that, the ability to increase our survivability starts with those level one skills. We're not going to be able to move ourselves so far away that we're going to be out of range. We have to be hard to find as well too. Some of that becomes through increased mobility, but some of that's through passive means as well too. Putting up camo netting in an effective way, not just draping it over the cab of a vehicle. And also, I think for the sustainers, having an aggressive mindset, a proactive mindset, we don't often see, units establishing LPOPs, in a proactive manner. As the rear area expands, really almost become this, like what would be traditionally like the MEB role in a division, like tying into our left and right units, I guess, to make sure we have a cohesive rear area security, if you will. Don't check me doctrinally on that at the brigade level, but that's sort of kind of the space that we're playing in with the BSA back there with fires back there, potentially with maybe whatever, what engineer remnants we might have, give or take, whatever that type of unit that's rolling through. But in doing so proactively, like, and sometimes we get attachments, best case it's MPs or maybe even a slice element of an infantry squad, if you will, but that's not always guaranteed. But if we do get those, how are we enabling those enablers, and buying down that risk, I guess? Are we passively putting them, at a checkpoint, a road security point, or are we doing some sort of roving security, and then tying that into our S2 feed to then inform the brigade on any enemy threats in the area? So that would probably be my that was a lot of advice, I guess. So hopefully we can grab some nuggets there in terms of how do we increase our survivability. I think I started small and then went really big, so hopefully I didn't lose anybody there.
Yeah, you got a lot of good nuggets there, sir. And I think, yeah, one, just, getting back to the basics is so critical. And I think it's across the board. And I just loved your point about the camo nets. Definitely think we need to do some camo netting classes. I've seen some really good ones in my time. I've seen some real bad ones that just, as you said, just drape it on the truck and say, oh, we're good, we have camo nets up. But there's actually a lot of functionality on how to set that up properly. So that'd be a good course unto itself. But when it comes to observing the changes, and we talked a little bit in, with the C2 conversation, but when it comes to all the changes coming with TIC, what are you seeing right now with the formations that are changing?
Yeah, I think, like I said earlier, it's kind of a real fun time to be at a CTC because you're sort of seeing all those sort of innovations being tested in the field. I think for me personally, it's encouraging to see the rapid integration and sort of acquisition of whatever technology it is. For us here, JMRC specifically, it's sort of just varied every rotation. I think that's how fast some of this transformation is occurring. I think, but most commonly, like I mentioned it before, right? It's the integration of Starlink, Starshield, MiFi Pucks that enables our ability to chat, most commonly through Wicker. You have log cops. I think actually it's been pretty standard now, either the brigade is fighting off of Maven, and then best case we get the log cop displayed on Maven as a Maven layer as well too. And so, obviously increase our shared understanding, I think, exponentially across the formation. Also, I think it's probably not news to most on here, but MBCTs even just transferring transitioning to the ISVs, and that's positive effect on class 3 consumption, right? Like that's almost, it's crazy how reliable those things are and how efficient they are. Really gives the brigade and associated BSBs or LSBs, I think, a lot of opportunity to, sustain the brigade in other ways, as that sort of buys down the risk for class 3 consumption or even parts consumption, if you will. So yeah, I think that's sort of in terms of, I think the initial question had to do with what we're seeing come through in terms of transformation. I will say though, so some of that technology that we're seeing introduced is bringing up maybe another problem set, which is battery consumption and sort of life cycling batteries. Like what's the best way to care for a battery and recharge a battery to ensure that you can get that SUAS up in time, and doing that through all the elements, right? If it's extremely hot or extremely cold, obviously batteries perform differently in those environments. So potentially, approaching that in a very deliberate fashion, almost in its own classes of supply, if you will, potentially depending on how, where the unit's at in their transformation stages. If they're heavy on battery consumption, they might want to really consider being a little more deliberate in sort of their management of that. What's crazy though, even with all that innovation, is you still have, For us logisticians, like we're still out there manually dipsticking fuelers, right? Like we're still counting pallets by hand. Like log cops still have most likely a human input at the very start of that log cop, right? So there's a lot of innovation space occurring, and we're also seeing sustainment challenges still sort of remain true to what they've been in the past. The means at which we're communicating them have been updated, but right now I don't think I'm shaking any trees by saying that it's still a very manual process on the sustainment side to at least get that data up there and for SPOs to do what they need to do.
Yeah, well, you just hit on a lot of good things. As you said, tick is changing so rapidly. When it comes to batteries, having served in the Arctic myself, I know that was always a struggle when it comes to battery life. But then for units that are coming to JMRC specifically, any good tips or tricks for them?
Yeah, so for JMRC specifically, I mean, I guess I'll just start with, you know, like if you have a good SOP or a tax op, this isn't JMRC specific, but understand that thing. And I think the more you know about it prior to coming in, the better off you are. And you can sort of use the rotation to either validate the thing or make improvements on it. But really, like, starting from nothing we're probably doing our service members a disservice if we don't. And that's down to the company level. That's sort of, I don't think that's unreasonable expectation for units to have. And I think we're at a point too where those things should not be a secret either. I think we should be sharing best of products at Echelon, because the last thing, and you know, I used to have a boss that would get so frustrated for staff officers, like trying to make a task org chart from scratch. And they're like, what are we doing? The task org chart should be almost standard, right? Like there should just be a running task org chart, and then you just modify it. We should not be making it from scratch. I think the same probably applies in the tax op SOP sort of arena, if you will, you know, as it applies to your formation. I think for, again, probably not JMRC specific, but, and you kind of mentioned it before, but setting your stuff up prior to arrival. And maybe you can't do that. Like I said, maybe it's even during A days, but giving some thought to what your MCP layout is going to look like. And a lot of that just boils down to, okay, like what's the purpose of this thing? Because sometimes that question's so broad, you're like, well, I mean, I don't even know what I want this node CP, like, what is it supposed to do? If you take your task and purpose, that is, and so you sort of backwards plan from that, if you will, and you can sort of build on to what your layout should be. That's sort of probably going to tell you, you know, who you should have in there, like the functions that they should be able to provide, and then how you're going to transfer, you know, that data, you know, because you're going to need to communicate it to somebody. And so, and thinking through those things is probably, you know, good to do prior to showing up. And then, you know, this isn't new, but if your whatever your pace plan is, I would encourage units to practice their pace plan prior to as well too. So I mean, if your pace plan is heavy on FM, like maybe consider doing those battle rhythm events. Again, I'm not the first person to say this, but doing those battle rhythm events over whatever your pace is. So you know, if you know you're going to be on if you know you're going to be on Starshield or Wicker or Maven, like what's a log stat look like over Wicker, or is that what we want to do or not? You know, do we have something that's formatted to that? How are our 5988s being submitted? Are we doing that or not? Is it running 5988? But if not, are we submitting through Wicker, or is it through other means, if you will? So I'm not sure. Hopefully, I gave some good tips and tricks. In that, but I think really it boils down to, like, is an endless amount of things that you can prepare for, and probably focusing on the three or four things at least initially, to help eat away at that elephant, if you will, goes a long way. And I think really a lot of it comes down to start with your task and purpose, and then backwards plan off of that, and that usually gets you to the answer to what you're looking for in terms of, you know, like, what am I for, you know? Well that, like, your task and purpose, your boss tells you that. And so if you know that, then you can kind of backwards plan off of the things that you should probably, like, work on or work to establish to allow you to get after that task and purpose that you've just been given.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, as you talked about, there's no reason, especially when you hit ground at a CTC, to be reinventing the products or starting from scratch. These things should already been built, and modify them as the environment changes. It's definitely a good point that you bring up, sir. So any good, now we focus a lot on units. So as one of our final things, what good advice do you have for someone that's about to be assigned as an OCT, specifically from your Foxwell? They're coming to JMRC, they're about to be an OC. How should they be prepared?
Yeah, so I think, one, we're looking, unlike anybody else, we're looking for talent, right? So we want, sort of the iron sharpened irons approach. We want you to be capable and experienced to be the OC. That is the one of one sort of match for us. But you have to be able to work on small teams. You have to be able to operate independently at times, if not a lot of times, especially under pressure during rotations. You need to have a good understanding of doctrine, but you also need to stay relevant. The COG told me and my peers as soon as we got here, we're irrelevant just based off of how fast the Army is transforming. So there's a balance there in terms of understanding doctrine, but also, like I said, staying in tune with the latest and greatest that's coming out. And sometimes that's rotation to rotation. You have to, an OC, I think you're putting in a tough position. And really I've never been an OC myself. Right. So I have all the respect in the world for OCs, cause I think it's an incredibly difficult job, but there's a certain level of EQ that person has to have as well to allow, or to really, to have the ability to coach and train somebody in a really tough environment that somebody is under a lot of stress, whether that be cause they don't have enough time or it's just, circumstantial pressures, what have you. And you have to be able to articulate in the best way, in a tactful way, opportunities to coach and train that person. So that way, you're advancing their ability to get their training objectives. There's really no ego or no place for ego in this job. I think, you also have to come to grips that, and so we're typically at whatever echelon you're at post KD. So you're no longer in command. It's not your show. But you still need to have that passion for providing, the best training possible. People that really love to do that. And luckily, across the board, I think really across JMRC, we have an organization full of people with that sort of mindset, able to draw on your experiences, share your struggles, and hopefully, before you see the RTU struggling, so that way they can relate to that lesson and be better than you were in that moment.
So anything good about the area where it comes for like OCs being there as permanent party?
Like specifically to Hohenfels. Yeah. So what I'd say is it's, I had never been stationed in Hohenfels. I think it's probably safe to say people probably think of it most as just being in the middle of nowhere. I think my pitch or response back to that, it's sort of in the middle of everything, if you will. It's a small unit or a small location. So it's like a small town vibe. But with that comes quick and easy access to the commissary, quick and easy access to a world-class clinic facility. I don't want to oversell them on what they can do, but it's been one of my best experiences, in terms of sort of, if you want to start talking life support isms, if you will, beautiful cities around, you have a UNESCO World Heritage Site, Regensburg, city just down the road, 30 minutes, from here, an hour and a half gets you to Munich. I think just 2 hours or so gets you to check. And then international airports, multiple going both ways. I think an hour to each one of those that can get you to a flight in Europe. So I think in my mind, it's a great location in terms of quality of life for, the service member when you can get it, but certainly your families as well too. They're well taken care of. And I think just really a tight-knit community in general, and a community that takes the quality of life for the family members incredibly serious, with the commitment and passion that and efforts that go into making it, like I said, a world-class environment for not just the RTU, but the permanent parties as well too.
All right. Well, definitely thank you for that, sir, because I know a lot of individuals out there listening, like, okay, I just got to sign this. What do I have to expect when I get there? So it's good that you're able to paint that picture for them, kind of give them that insight on both just their job, what to expect when it comes to being OC, as well as the environment around them. So is there anything that we missed today that you wanted to add to the conversation?
Yeah. Hey, so the one thing I did say, and I don't know if you have a lot of people jump on this, but I would say what I meant to say earlier too is, you know, if it's difficult, it's probably worth doing. And if it's worth doing, it's most likely worth rehearsing. Right. And that could be applied to a lot of the topics that we're talking about here. I think units right now, especially as I describe sort of the constraints that units are showing up with not a lot of time, to achieve probably the collective training that they want to, creatively thinking how they get those sets and reps, prior to arriving, you know, into X1, you know, my mind goes to displacing the BSA, jumping and or synchronizing, you know, the CTC, FTC, sustainment rehearsals, thinking through that. And even if it's just like a tabletop exercise of these things, I think is really good. And it would probably set the unit up for a lot of success, putting some thought and or some time into the ability to rehearse those things that are difficult and important, and they're you know, they are those things, but that's why we rehearse them.
Well, and thank you for that, sir. I know we've had a lot of wisdom, and you're just sitting here. It's you just gave me even more wisdom there. But is there anything else you want to add for us, specifically the systemic committee, you know, outside of just the CTC from your years of experience?
You know, I don't know. I mean, what I'll say is just to the broader systemic community, and really just, I guess, you know, junior leaders, you know, take care of your career, right? Like this, and this is a career, whether you're in for your initial term or you actually decide to go beyond that. I think one, thank you for your service. Two, you sort of define what success looks like. So do what you can to grab onto a mentor. And if somebody hasn't approached you, you can absolutely, like it is within your right to ask somebody to be your mentor as well too, which that took me a long time to understand, that you can ask, and you will almost always be met with a smile. And if you're not, then it's, you know, move on to the next, I think would probably be the best advice there anyways. But really give some time, and it's easy for me to say this now, but you know, what's your why? Why are you serving? Give that some thought. I think goes a long way to really understanding what you want to do with your career. And if the better you can see yourself with that, I think you can, the easier you can see yourself. And when you're thinking about those, hey, what's your 5-year plan? You know, what's your 10-year plan? And so giving some thought about that, and going through that mentor exercise, I think is probably something that, advice that applies to beyond the systemic community, but really any junior leader that's listening.
Well, thank you for that, sir. As you brought up, it's great to be able to have this wisdom that you're able to just really just put out to the community, even out those outside of the sustainment community. And I think this is a good episode just going through these CTCs mini series, is that we're not like, well, we focus in on the sustainment side of the house. Like this applies to anybody going to a CTC, or the wisdom you're just talking about when it comes to going through your career there. But I know we kind of just scratched the surface with everything that comes with JMRC. I know there's so much more we could talk about, especially when it comes to the various international exercises that are conducted there, you know, which truly makes this such a unique CTC. So where can people find you at if they do have any additional follow-up questions?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on Global, just like everybody. I don't think there's too many Andrew Horns on there. So I'm the only one, you know, at JMRC, I guess. So find me there, and absolutely look forward to anybody reaching out. I'm available through all means, Teams, if you want to just send a quick message there, or email, obviously. But that's where folks can find me at.
Well, thank you so much, sir, for just taking the time to meet with me virtually. You know, even across an ocean on a different continent and in a different time zone, we can still have these great conversations to just inform our community on all the great things that's happening across the globe and within the systemic enterprise. But the wisdom you provide today will just help so many going forward. So I just truly, sir, want to thank you again.
Yeah, Garrett, thanks. Like I said, thanks to you and your team. One, like I said, initially up front, for the flexibility and the patience, if you will, as we had to reschedule this a couple times, but we persevered. And this is an honor, truly, to just be a small part in this effort that you have. And I don't know about the wisdom that you're preaching there, but, you know, it's my humble piece to what I think, like I said, this we can get back to really set units up to be successful for any CTC, hopefully.
Well, thank you very much, sir, for that. And there you have it, folks, the Army's only forward station CTC. We've explored the deserts of California with NTC, the swamps of Louisiana with JRTC, and now across the Atlantic Ocean with a European-based theater with JMRC. All that's left is to jump across the other side of the United States and the Pacific Theater to JPMRC. Stay tuned for next week's episode. We will close out this mini-series with a CTC that handles both jungle and Arctic training. You won't want to miss it. But that is all we have today, folks. As always, sustainment leaders start here. See you next time. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Logstat. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Please share this episode across your formation and leave us a review. If you have a topic you'd like here discussed, then please reach out to us at armysustainment@army.mil or directly to me on Global at garrett.h.pyle. Follow us on Facebook, X, and LinkedIn at Army Sustainment. We'll see you next time. Sustainment leaders start here.